because my man has gone.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Travelin' Light by Billie Holiday, who was released on this day in 1942. In this hour, we're listening to the latest installment of our series, The World of the Play, where we look at some of the issues behind plays at Everyman Theater. This time, we're looking at Blithe Spirits. It's a Noel Coward play about an eccentric medium, Madame Arcati, performing a seance that goes wrong when novelist Charles Condobine finds himself caught in an improbable love triangle between his living wife and the ghost of his ex-wife. We talk about ghosts, spiritualism, and the afterlife. Enjoy.
Welcome, everybody. Good to have you here and at Everyman Theater for our World of Play discussion. And so we're going to find out what happens today when a scholar meets a medium, meets a Ghostbuster. And it's actually going to be a very interesting and serious discussion. We're looking forward to having you all jump up. And let me introduce our panel. At the very end, Dr. Hollis Robbins. Hollis is director of the Center for Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, chair of the Humanities Department at Peabody. She's written some incredible stuff on 19th century African-American literature that I've happened to have read. She has a PhD from English from Princeton, and at the very end there, and next to her is Dr. Gwen McGregor. I had to say it like that. Couldn't help myself. Who is a nationally recognized intuitive life coach, a metaphysical educator, and she's worked with places like Inside Edition, America's Most Wanted, and more, and has a PhD, Doctor of Divinity from ULCCA. And I asked her what a Whitnath was, which is a transpersonal hypnotherapy, WHTNATH. And next to her and next to me, Elise Caudill Corker is lead investigator with the Greater Maryland Paranormal Society. She's been there since 2007, taking part in many, many investigations. And her area, she's really trying to find scientific evidence of the paranormal in our lives. And in the world. And the play we've just seen clearly is like many plays that kind of wrestle with this paranormal thing that every society has. And so I'm going to start actually with that. And that starts with Hollis. Just to kind of go back. And I mean, when you look at a lot of the great literature, plays, films in this era in the 20th and 21st century, the paranormal, talking to the other side, being in that kind of communication is very serious. I mean, it happens over and over again. It's part of our human culture.
Well, I wanted to start actually talking about Shakespeare, which is probably the times most people have seen ghosts on stage. And for Shakespeare, it was less about the paranormal, partly about religious questions of whether ghosts occur in newly Protestant England, what that meant about heaven and earth and purgatory. But it was also a matter of Shakespeare's putting the internal of the character material on stage, so that Hamlet begins with a ghost, begins with who's there, and you see the ghost of Hamlet's father. And in Macbeth, famously, in Act 3, I think, when Banquo's ghost comes to the banquet, and Macbeth is the only one that can see him, and everybody's like, you're crazy, which you could see a lot of Macbeth happening here in Noel Coward's play. But the ghosts there are really a matter of what the person is feeling, what the actor on stage is feeling being materialized, either guilt or fear or trepidation or atonement or any other deep emotion. So long before Freud, it was really a matter of when you ask what a playwright wants to do in putting a ghost on stage, historically it was about a representation of the irrational or not the non-representational. And then if you think about, I was thinking of The Shining today, another place where you see ghosts in film, and there it is a matter of not somebody that the character knew beforehand, but a deep fear of a sort of the social past, an Indian burial ground, something that there is a collective national guilt or social guilt about, that would be then represented by a manifestation that makes everybody feel very bad.
So, let me get you into this. I was thinking about the play, Blithe Spirit, and how the medium plays this very powerful role. It always is this medium that seems to do this work. I'm curious what you felt in that play. terms
well,
of the work
you know,
you do?
I loved her discussion. You know, I loved what she said. You know, as someone who's been, you know, very odd all my life in this regard, one of the things that becomes really apparent is, you know, that you're in another realm. I mean, you're hearing, you're seeing, you're feeling things quite differently. And but a lot of what she said, you know, when I do seances, it's very familiar. I mean, I don't have to go through a child to speak, but I thought that it was a great representation. And, you know, in the late 1900s and the early, the late 1800s, early 1900s, this was very common. You know, there'd been many more wars. People were missing relatives. In the early 1920s, we had, you know, a horrendous flu epidemic. You know, people wanted to contact, you know, the people that had left in great numbers. And I think that the spiritualist church, which brought forward a lot of this, but, you know, there were some very legitimate people that came forward, too. But I think that we've always wanted to reach into that higher place and dwell there, you know, anyway. And I think we can. I think it happens all the time. But I thought it was artfully very well done. And a lot of the language was like, yeah, I can say that. Yeah, I believe that. That makes sense to me. Now, of course, she's a character, but, you know, many of us are. But a lot of what she did was very, you know, getting quiet, getting everybody quiet, you know, in a peaceful place, bringing forward souls into a greater reality. It happens all the time. We don't see them that way. We feel them often. I'm not saying we don't see them, because many people do, but we certainly feel them. And, you know, it's believable. I've seen it happen a lot of times. And I just love Noel Coward anyway. He's just, you know, a cool guy.
What's not to like?
Yeah, what's not to like?
I needed this play badly, as I was badly to laugh. Yeah. But I think I want to get into this, starting here, Elise, and then I want to dive into something with the three of you and then with the audience here. Is the reality of it. Because this is a part of the great battle we have around this kind of discussion. It's between the rational and the irrational, between what the earthbound, pragmatic, day-to-day existence and things that are beyond us we don't seem to understand, and do they even exist? I mean, that is, you know, the three of you, let's get into that for a moment.
Well, for me, it's interesting, because with the show, you see, and I feel you on this part, some of the things that were said, I'm like, yeah, I've said that. I've been the person sitting in a dark room saying, knock yes for once, knock twice for no. And it seems kind of silly, but not a whole lot has changed over history in terms of
us. Done that.
I've done that. I've been that person, yes. And just... not a lot has changed throughout history of our curiosity of what's on the other side. I think what has changed is our skepticism. We aren't as spiritual of a society as I think we once were, or religious in different terms. And we want concrete proof. We want scientific evidence of the paranormal. We want to be able to show a video or play a recording, and or see a manifestation in front of our face in order to believe it. And
but isn't that what you do in part?
That is
right?
Exactly what I do.
Right.
So it's not that I don't believe it's there unless I see it or, you know, have proof of it. I wouldn't even do what I do if I didn't believe it was there to begin with. But what my group does, the Greater Maryland Paranormal Society, is we are really there to either prove or disprove what people think is happening in their home. Whether we're able to debunk their claims, meaning we're able to find natural occurrences for what's going on, or we're able to really back up what they're experiencing with EVPs or...
What's an EVP?
An EVP is electronic voice phenomenon. So it's the concept of a voice being recorded that you can't hear with your own ear. So that's what we do. So we're really there to either prove or disprove the paranormal. And
Both in terms of our literary history and in terms of the reality that you all work, the two of you work in especially, what do we mean by paranormal? What does that mean? When we talk about the paranormal, what are we talking about?
Well, if I can break in the fictional realm, there's no difference between a fictional character on stage. If you're playing a real person or if you're playing a ghost, right? It's still you're playing a materialization of a fictional character or a materialization of a ghostly fictional character. For we, the audience, or on stage, it doesn't make a difference, which is why I think ghosts play such a nice role on stage, because they both, the idea of the actor is to make that individual real, whether it's a real ghost or a real person. It's from nothing comes to something. And I think this is why fiction does such a nice job in making real something that you guys are actually dealing with in reality, because in reality, not on stage, there may be a difference between a ghost and a person. And in terms of the ways we live our lives, I mean, to be haunted by a memory, you know, to have somebody feel like their presence is something we deal with. You know, you see somebody who walks down the street who reminds you of a loved one. You feel that ghostly presence just manifested in some way. And I was reminded of, in, I think, January 1831, Ralph Waldo Emerson lost his beloved first wife, Ellen, and he used to walk to her tomb every single day because her spirit haunted him. He grieved so deeply. And on March 29th, 1832, very famous moment in literature, he opened the tomb after 14 months and looked inside. And on his in his journal that day, he said, went to Ellen's tomb and opened the coffin. And that's it. Didn't write anything for a couple more days. And then went on to it for his life, quit his job, moved out of his house, sold all his furniture, left, and a few years later got remarried, and had to do that to put that grief away, to get rid of whatever it was that was haunting him. It was a really poignant moment. And then his second wife, Lydian, when they actually had a daughter, she said, why don't we name it Ellen? Which was a very nice thing for a second wife to do. Yeah, and absolutely. It was beloved, and they stayed happily married for the rest of their life. So I thought that was a kind of interesting story that I was thinking of while I was watching the play.
Gwen?
Well, and for me, you know, ghosts are that love of the spirit that has gone on, that wanting and longing to see someone again. You know, the personification of the second wife, you know, coming in symbolically real to me, you know, it all, I think we long for
Wait,
this.
Did you say symbolically real? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, she's a reality, but she, you know, I think everyone wants to be able to feel, see, connect with those people who have gone to a higher energy realm. You know, I still believe we're all in the same school. You know, I'm in second grade. Mom and Dad are in fourth grade. You know, I know we're still in the same building. You know, we're still here together. But, you know, I think every contact and I think the fascination, the continual fascination is because we can feel them. We can see them. We know that life is everlasting, that spirit of God or whatever you want to call it is forever. And, you know, I think that we're reminded of it through movies and literature and song all the time because we're tied to it. It is us. It is part of us. We're spirit moving through form. That's our reality. That's who we really are. So, you know, this little mammal isn't who I am through eternity. And I know I'm linked to everybody in this room. It's so funny, while you were speaking, I saw this woman. She's walking right through the back of the room, and she's got a long white skirt on.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I keep doing this, don't I? White skirt. I've got such a loud voice, I'm, you know, kind of averse to this. But she's walking through the back there in her house. She's in her own house. And she's got a white, you know, blouse on, long white skirt on. She clearly belongs to another time. She's walking through her time as we're existing right now. Is she even noticing us? No. You know, and that often happens. But, you know, I did a party yesterday, and I looked up, and there was a Union soldier looking at me across the room. And, you know, he just looked at me, and I looked at him, and I looked away. He disappeared. And how could I do that? Because I was in a higher self. That's why when we have these beautiful dreams and visions, we are able to see these souls again so clearly. And, you know, when you talk to people about the sight of them, there's no doubt. They have absolutely no doubt of what they're feeling, what they're hearing. And, you know, it's just so wonderful that it's interwoven through our great literature, our great music, through our hearts.
Just a quick raise of the hand in the audience here. I'm just curious. How many people in this audience feel like they have felt something like this before in their lives? And how many people in this audience feel like they are completely rational human beings? I'm not, that's not a mocking question. I'm a very serious question. So, I mean, because I, yeah, no, no, because you can be part of this rational world and not even believe in God and have strange things happen,
yeah,
right? Definitely. And that we cannot explain, just like in the beginning of the play. Couldn't explain what was going on. Mm-hmm. Something was happening. So, I mean, but so I want to get to the three of you to talk about this describing from your own experiences intellectually and in terms of the work that you do as well. What is it people are experiencing? What do you think? What's your theory, your notion about what is happening when these things happen, like in Blithe Spirits, like in everybody's existence? What is happening?
Well, I think a number of things can be happening. They could legitimately be having a paranormal experience, meaning they have a spirit or entity in their home and that's what they're experiencing. Or they could have recently have a loved one passed on and they want so desperately to connect with that deceased loved one, and they have called in a group of paranormal investigators because they want to connect with the other side. Now, that's not what my group does, but I feel like we wear a lot of hats. You know, we come in and we're there to help. And whether that's proving that, yes, the door that slams in your house all the time is a ghost, or, you know, it's really just that you have a drafty house. We're helping them find an answer. We had an investigation once where the woman did have her mom just recently pass away, and she was convinced that she was feeling her mother around her. And we came in and did a very thorough scientific investigation, meaning we set up cameras, we set up voice recorders, we measured the temperature, we measured the electromagnetic fields in the home, all of those things to look for, you know, discrepancies and spikes and trying to capture something on camera. And in the end, we didn't capture anything. And the main takeaway for me was, you know, we didn't catch anything. We didn't catch any scientific evidence that there's a ghost or a spirit in your home, but that doesn't mean that there's not. That doesn't mean that your mother is not with you. It just means that she did not choose to make herself known in that moment. And I think that's really important to remember, is that you don't need a video or a picture of your deceased mother to know that she's with you. And in that way, we were able to help that client.
Gwen, you're looking like you're itching to jump into the mic. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I was thinking is, you know, on the stage in the play, you know, whenever two or more are gathered in my name is a very common quote in many faiths. And, you know, the idea is, even though they originally were going to laugh, you know, at the madam, they thought, you know, there were some real believers sitting there, the doctor's wife being one of them. Then you, I don't want to blow this if you haven't seen the play, but, you know, in the end, you find out that there's someone who's a very big transformer, transistor receptor in the play. And, you know, I like to point out that even if you have a belief or a wonder or a curiosity, you know, you've got the souls of God collected doing this work together. You know, I used to work out of my home, and I'd do readings all day, and I would come home. I, you know, as many of you who work at home, you know, I just had to get out. You know, I'd go to dinner somewhere, I'd come back, and pillows would be all over the living room. They'd be in the dining room. And the first time it happened, I thought I'd been robbed. I'm like, you know, who threw the pillows, you know? But it's not that. It's the energy. And you have people that are such high transmitters of energy, which makes it easier also with this very sensitive equipment Elise works with to pick up a lot of their presences. But, you know, I just want to point out that a lot of what I receive, I believe, comes from the fact that we are linked together, that there's this huge spiritual network that you can call on, just like there's a huge spiritual, you know, a university called Johns Hopkins that we can call upon, as above, also below. You know, I believe in things that I can't see, because I know there has to be something smarter, better, sweeter than me on this planet. And, you know, it just makes sense. And, you know, it feels wonderful. And, you know, the experiences, you know, people say to me, how did you know that? How did you know to say that to me? And I'm like,
I don't know it. I just felt it. You know, it's not mine. I don't own this information, but you know that it's real. That my heart's open. That your heart's open. It means something. You know, it means something.
It's funny. I'm loving listening to the two of you because we come at things from very different perspectives. I think, and from my perspective as a scholar, have you guys seen the movie? Most people have seen the movie Sixth Sense, the Bruce Willis movie that came out while I was in grad school, and it was a joke among all of us. You know, I see dead people. Well, I live with dead people, whether it's Shakespeare or Harriet Beecher Stowe or Frederick Douglass. I see dead people all the time. I spend my entire day with dead people, and it doesn't matter to me that they are dead. They are as alive to me as anything else. And for me, it's not a matter of whether I believe in, it's not a higher plane to me. It's actually the plane that one works with when one's a scholar. I mean, when I was talking to you about Claude McKay the other day. I was studying his poems, studying his life, studying his work, and realizing that his self, his physical being, will always be with me and with his readers through the poetry he writes, through the texts he writes. You know, I resist calling it anything supernatural. It is just what text does. It is what an author does in creating a character. You know, there's a joke we all sort of sit around and talk about, like, if you could have one person to dinner at any, you know, with you at any time, past, present, and future, who would you have for dinner? And the question is, before you play this game, well, fictional or factual? You know, could I have Shakespeare, or would I prefer to have Hamlet? Which, of course, would be terrible because he wouldn't decide what he wanted to eat. Right? Because at a certain point, when you're conjuring somebody up, right, it doesn't really matter whether they're living or dead or fictional or factual, that the text has found a way to manifest it itself and that this person is completely real to you. And I feel bad a little bit for actors who play these roles if you're inhabiting somebody alive or somebody dead. I was going to ask you afterwards about playing ghosts, if it's harder, but I might ask you afterwards.
Well, actors do. I mean, actors inhabit someone else and become that place in that moment, or you couldn't do the job as an actor, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I often find acting as a spiritual act, can be a very spiritual act, but I want to come back to kind of really wrestle with where we ended up. And when we talk about we all dwell here. Where is that word dwelling? I mean, you know, I mean, what does it mean when somebody can look at this and go, okay, well, this means, if I give you a quick story. My mother passed away. I was there when she died in another room in the hospital. And I immediately called my brother and said, Brian, Mom's dead. And Brian said, before I get the word Mom's dead out, he said, I know. She was just sitting at the end of my bed saying goodbye. And was like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, and so when those... Mm-hmm. So those of us with these kind of logical minds, right? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? I mean, how do things happen? What just happened there? And I think that happens to lots of people, and they can't quite put their hands around what those moments mean. There's this deep connection between somebody you love because it's there, and you can't describe what that energy is. We don't know scientifically what it means, but something is there. You know what I mean? But to talk like as the people in the audience, this has happened to me numerous times in my 69 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, again, we're spirit moving through form. So the real energy of love and the real energy of connection is there first, you know, well before our brains. I believe that energy is what moves the brain. I don't think the brain moves the energy. And, you know, I think there are powerful love connections, but, you know, I think if your heart's open, I think you can pick up energy and messages, and you can see trends in the world. You can understand. Anyone who does Reiki work or true healing understands that it's their love that is facilitating some of the healing. You know, we're not healers because we go to medical school. You know, and I believe very strongly that the arts, music, beauty, joy, that's God. You know, that's moving through us from spirit. I think those wonderful muses that we talk about that come to us, I think it's higher self. I think that the brain is just interpreting for the higher self, and luckily we've got great universities and very smart people that know enough to do all the right work to be able to bring forth such beauty. But, you know, and again, the gift of being a teacher, the gift of working with a community and the public, the gift of acting, this is a great compassionate work. And I think we tend to forget it. But what leads you to that compassionate work? I think it's your soul of God. I think it's the connection to the higher self. I think it's the connection to the growth. Many of you will leave here today and have dreams tonight, one, because of the subject matter, two, because of the level of interest and caring in this group. And, you know, I when I leave homes, I tell people, you probably don't want to sleep in that room. And they're like, oh, no, really? I think I want to sleep in the room. And I'm like, well, you know, good luck, because you're going to have to interpret a lot of energy. But, you know, it's wonderful.
I was going to say, yeah. The word you said you used was dwelling, because I think dwelling is a word that actually captures what the issue is. You dwell with something. Dwelling can mean a place. You live in a dwelling, but we also dwell on something, or dwell on people, or dwell on a topic. And Heidegger talks about this a great deal, about how the dwelling in time and the dwelling in the being in time is the human condition. It is the fact that we want to stay, but we also sometimes want to move. Which is why I think about the Emerson story. He did not want to dwell on his first wife anymore. He did not want to dwell in the place where she was. He did not want to dwell with the memories, which is, I think, we see at the end of Blithe Spirit. I don't want to give anything away to people who haven't seen it yet, but the fact of not wanting to dwell anymore, I think, is also a perfectly appropriate response to perhaps too much dwelling with the past, or with loss, or with death.
We're listening to the latest installment of our series, The World of the Play. We look at some of the issues behind the scenes of the plays at Everyman Theater. This time we're talking about the play Blithe Spirit. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. We'll be right back. And on our way to break, it's Same Man by Bo Diddley from his album Go Bo Diddley, released on this day in 1959. Welcome back. And that's Poison Ivy by the Coasters. Carl Gardner of the Coasters passed away on this day in 2011. And I'm Mark Steiner. You're right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. In this hour, we're listening to the latest installment of our series, The World of the Play. We look at some of the issues behind the plays at Everyman Theater. This time, we're looking at the play Blithe Spirit. It's a Noel Coward play about an eccentric medium, Madame Arcardi, performing a seance that goes wrong when novelist Charles Condamine finds himself caught in an improbable love triangle between his living wife and the ghost of his ex-wife. We talk about ghosts, spiritualism, and the afterlife, and I'm joined by Elise Caudill Corker, a founding member and lead investigator with the Greater Maryland Paranormal Society, Dr. Gwen F. McGregor, a nationally recognized intuitive life coach and metaphysical educator, and Dr. Hollis Robbins, director of the Center for Africana Studies at the Johns Hopkins University and chair of the Humanities Department at Peabody Institute.
I mean, there's always been this debate, and between what comes first, matter or spirit, spirit or matter. Even though he's
I thought
not
it was chicken or egg.
Well, chicken or egg, yeah. But the idea is that, do we create the spirit because of our matter? Or is there something that's beyond us we don't quite understand? I mean, that's part of what the rational-irrational debate always is in among different circles in humankind, right? Mm-hmm. Always.
Absolutely. I always go down that humble path, and there's got to be something smarter, better, prettier, thinner than me. And, you know, only because I've seen it and I know it to be true. And, you know, when I was through with third grade, I went to fourth grade. When I was through with fourth grade, I went to fifth grade. As above, also below is thought of very highly through many cultures and many faiths. And, you know, so, and by the way, I don't think it's the chicken or the egg. I think it's the rooster. I think it's Father God. I think it's the idea. I think it's the illumination. And I just think we all have it. You know, it's just a wonderful, and it's a wonderful time that we can come to this beautiful theater. This is just, the energy in this theater is just delightful, I just might add, if I may. Just a little plug.
Well, I have a bit more to say about that, but Hollis, did you want to say something? You look like you're about to. If not,
No, I was just, Freud really gave us a certain amount of language as well to talk about what is internal and what is our unconscious. And, you know, people say things like it's the wine talking or my fear talking or that there's other things inside your head that are giving voice to. And whether it be your id or some sort of manifestation of your superego, I do think that this, again, the idea of there being a multiple persons or multiple ways of understanding the world through our unconscious, having that materialize. I mean, again, those of us who work with language, who understand that language can make real, would say it's hard to know whether language is spirit or matter. So I would just then argue, even with that dichotomy.
But it might be a false dichotomy, but I mean, one of my friends just passed away. That was always the argument,
right?
That there was no spirit before matter, he would always argue, right? That didn't exist. And I'll hold it.
I think I conjure things up through memory. I don't, for those of us whose parents are gone, I never see my parents, but things happen, and I think of them. I laugh because I never laughed so much as when I was with my mother, and we would get that, you know, can't stop crying, wet your pants laughing. You know, we only had to look at each other and we could just start laughing. And sometimes I'll be in a situation but it's always memory as I define it. And my mother-in-law's noodle kugel, when I make it, we think of her. We never see her, but it's a memory. So I don't know if it's all the same thing and I'm naming it differently or not.
I've got a different way of looking at it. What makes you think that you're driving down the road and all of a sudden you remember something, you know, when you were 8 years old with mom? What makes you think mom didn't trigger that? You know, I want to tell you, as much as I have to listen to them say, we hate being called dead. Don't call us dead. We're as real as you are, and we love you dearly. But I want to tell you, they say it to me all the time. You know, we talk to them all the time, and sometimes they hear us, sometimes they don't. But when something comes to you out of the blue, like, you know, I haven't made that recipe for, you know, 8 years, and I just feel the need to do that. What makes you think that she didn't bring that thought to you?
Well, and it's interesting, at least in literature, there are two different kinds of ghosts. One would have been that manifestation of memory, which Shakespeare does with Hamlet's father or Banquo's ghost. But when thinking of a film or a book like The Shining, where it is an Indian burial ground, it's not a memory that you yourself had, but the national mourning, the national tragedy, some tragedy that you took part of that isn't your memory but can haunt you because of where you are or your participation in a culture. And so ghosts of African Americans, of slaves, of the Middle Passage, when you think of stories that tell that conjure up national shame or a national guilt. Therefore, it wouldn't be your memory, but it could haunt you in ways, not that you knew somebody, but that because you live here.
Elise, go ahead.
I was just thinking, and I keep going back to this, and I know you've brought up a couple of different instances in literature, but I keep going back to Harry Potter, which might sound a little bit funny, but in one of the scenes is Dumbledore and Harry in this King's Cross Station where he's partially died, I guess you could say. And he says, you know, are you real or are you in my head? And he says, well, of course I'm in your head, but what makes you think that I'm not real?
That's great.
And I go back to that a lot whenever I have dreams and I say, oh, you know, my granddad visited me in a dream last night. It was in my head, but to me it was very real. And maybe that was him visiting and saying hi and checking in.
Well, I mean, I'll throw this out and see a hand. I was thinking about, at least I were talking before the panel began, and I told a story. And the story was this, that this is about maybe 30 years ago in the 80s. Was that 30 years ago? Okay. and there was an actor, a friend of mine. We had just finished doing a piece together, and he said, come to my family's gathering. We're having this big party. So he was a McDonough, which were the McDonoughs, and in Maryland. And so we went out to the McDonough, what was the McDonough plantation. So we were out there at the McDonough plantation, and they were all talking, and I was getting pretty bored with the party. And I walked out into this field and sat under this old oak tree. And all of a sudden, it started getting cold. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And I kept hearing, feeling, like a wailing. Some weird pain thing was going through me. So I got up and looked and then walked back to the house. And the grandmother was there, who lived there at the home. And the McDonald's plantation. And she said, oh, where'd you go? She said, have a drink. I said, thank God, I'll have a drink. A couple. And so... And she said, where were I? I said, I was out in the field by that old oak tree. I said, oh, those are the slave quarters. Mm-hmm. And I sat down with that drink. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, so maybe that's somebody, my friend who just passed away, would say, as a rationalist, that's a coincidence. You were just cold. Stuff happened. You're in the field. And you walked in. And you're on a plantation. You thought about this crap before it started. And that's why it happened. And someone else would say, no, you felt something because you were in a field and didn't know what was going on, and this, something was bubbling up. So this is where the argument happens between rational, irrational, spirit, non-spirit, material, that we get very confused about what is going on in this world. And is this something that Noel Coward and Shakespeare and everybody else kind of makes up so we can have a fun time at the theater? You know, or.
I think that's why we have jobs in the paranormal field is because people want answers to that question. And I don't know that there is an answer that you can give that can please everyone. And we're socialized to think that stuff isn't real. We need evidence. We need to see it in front of us to believe it for the most part. And so that's why, you know, we do what we do is to hopefully find that scientific evidence. But even if, like I said before, even if we don't catch that EVP, that voice on that voice recorder, we don't catch that ghost in the picture, doesn't mean it wasn't there.
Jump in, Hollis. I want you to take this from the other point of view.
No,
if
I
you
mean,
have
I,
another
I, point,
maybe at the same
I mean,
point.
It's
of view.
The
I have
same
no idea.
Point. I mean, the word sight, right? Insight and sight and vision and perspective. You know, the same word captures the phenomenon, whether it's, you know, whether it's a ghost or whether it's a ghost in your head, right? That language allows us to actually to which is why I think language transcends the spirit versus matter phenomenon. You can't have one without the other, because language, the language of having sight or insight is the same thing whether you're looking at something material or something spiritual.
And who knows what this head is and what it really is. Yeah.
I wanted to address, I guess, Hollis and Dr. McGregor. I keep thinking of vibrational energy, and with your story, the ancient druids believed that the rocks, the trees, the earth absorbed energy from past events or from traumatic events or something that may have occurred there, even if it was a great love, that it absorbed that vibrational energy. And there are many stories from Gettysburg in the Civil War where people would see a whole regiment marching, ghost regiment marching across the field, but as soon as they cut down the trees, no one saw it anymore. And that made me think of your story when you were sitting under the oak tree. Could that oak tree have absorbed some of that energy, and you were simply picking up on the vibrational energy that the earth was emanating? Also, the Bible says, and I am a spiritual person, I'm not a religious person, I will preface that, but the Bible does say, in the beginning there was the Word, And that was the beginning. It was a word. It was vibrational energy. And that really just kind of excites me that I think we all carry that vibration. We are batteries. We are a soul with a body. We aren't a body with a soul. So I just think it's just really fascinating that I agree with you, Dr. McGregor. We are all so connected. And sometimes that battery picks up on the energy.
I was thinking of Gettysburg, and you picked it up. The first time I went to Antietam, I'd never been there before. We got there after hours, and this is before, you know, they cordoned it off so you couldn't walk the grounds. And I went with my best buddy, whose grandmother founded Lilydale in New York. So, you know, we were two spooky little kids growing up together, and with a grandmother to boot. But I could hear, we got out of the car, and before I got to the we were heading towards the center thinking it was open, I could hear the cannons going off. I could hear screams and yells, and you could hear and feel, it's a feel really most of the time for me, and I could feel people walking beside me trying to tell me their stories. And you know, I don't try to explain it anymore. I just know it's happening. And you know, I believe, and people laugh when I say this, good manners are everything, folks, in life and in death. You keep your heart open. You address them openly. You invite them, you know, when it's correct in your timing, to speak to you. There is something that happens in the play that I've not seen, other than in Ghostbusters, sorry, the ectoplasm. I have not seen that. I've seen, you know, people who have films of it. But so I know it occurs. But definite movement, definitely in seances, you know, people speaking in tongues, people, you know, all of a sudden, I make all my people bring photos with them, because often in the middle of the seance, people will say, you know, I saw a man, he's standing behind you, Gwen, you know, he's got dark hair, he's got horn-rimmed dark glasses, and one day this lady described my dad perfectly, and I'm like, you know, here for them, and this woman's talking to me about my father, and she has no idea, but I mean, happens all the time. And we would show the pictures at the end so that people would say, I saw that man, you know. I think it's a different network. I think it's an energy network. I think it proves that we're tied together, but we're also there in spirit with a mission. So, you know, I think we can have these missions, these times where we can bring this, you know, these ideas and people and love together. And I think it can be real powerful.
When you said about your head, that actually was what I was thinking. I think some of us have different neurologies, and I think the ability to pick up those type of perceptions comes with a certain brain. And, you know, like the savants and the geniuses that say, the music was dictated to me, I just wrote it down. Mm-hmm. We have too much of that. And the line that Noel Coward used from Shakespeare, what is it, Horatio, there's more mystery in heaven and earth than in your philosophy. I think that's so true. So,
Hollis?
Well, actually, I started out, while you were starting out, was thinking about at Peabody, where we teach, there's a number of students who, on a different left brain, right brain spectrum, you might describe as on the Asperger's spectrum. And in teaching students like that, who are wonderful musicians but can't have difficulties with metaphor, have difficulties with abstraction. And though I can deal with this really easily, I mean, I can, you know, have insight, have visions, understand in the imaginary realm, I understand that many can't. And there's nothing wrong with them if they can't see that. I mean, if everything is material and reality, and for these students, it's just a different way of one's brain working. I think you're exactly right. And certainly I think that those individuals who can't feel social vibrations as acutely as many of us can, and are thought of in some autism literature as disabled because of it, is perhaps a little bit unfair, because You know, there's certainly a lot that those people who don't have social interaction or can't feel those vibrations or couldn't possibly know what we're talking about here have a lot to contribute as well.
Come over here.
Elise, this is for you. Can you give an example or two of times where you did feel that you proved a spirit or ghost was in the house? And I'm curious, did that ghost belong to the people of the house or to someone else?
we have caught, and I use the word caught for lack of a better term, evidence of the paranormal. I'm not very sensitive to it. So I'm always the one where we go into an investigation and I never feel anything. Nothing ever happens to me. I never get touched. My hair never gets pulled. Like, I've never seen anything. I'm just not sensitive to it. I'm open to it, but I'm not sensitive to it. So typically for me, it's just a lot of sitting around in a dark room and asking questions that I can't hear the answers to. But we have had a couple of really great investigations. And to address your question of did they belong to those people or not, who knows? You know, we don't, there's no way of saying that was your mother. She's saying hello. And it might have been, but we can't. We're working specifically in scientific evidence, so we're really just bringing you the recording that we caught or the picture that we have. But more often than not, I would say that entity is connected to that location or whoever dwells in that house. There are two different types of what we call hauntings: residual and intelligent. An intelligent haunting would be something that interacts with you, so you can ask questions and you maybe get an answer on your recorder, and that's what we call an EVP. Or you, like in the play, when they say knock once for yes or two for no, and you actually do get a knock for yes or whatever, that would be an intelligent haunting. It's interacting with you. A residual haunting would be more like what you described, where you saw the woman walking through her house. It's an imprint almost, like a tape recorder playing over and over again. It's that energy imprinted, I guess. And what I would say one of the greatest investigations we did was actually, wasn't even a private home. It was the old Westminster Church where Edgar Allan Poe was buried. And of course it was around Halloween. They called us in because everything's much more haunted around Halloween. And they asked us to come in, and there was going to be a radio station to record our investigation. And they said, just go about your business and do what you do. So I was the only woman on the team that night. It was me and three of our male investigators. And we did our normal investigation. We set up our home base, which is where we have our computer, and we have infrared cameras set up all over the place. They feed into the computer and record. We have voice recorders set throughout, and we'll, you know, travel around the space and do EVP sessions where we're asking questions, which are a lot like what you see in the play. Is there anyone here who'd like to speak with us tonight? And, you know, knock once for yes, or can you finish this rhythm, and knocking on, you know, a familiar rhythm on the table, something like that. Those are really kind of a shot in the dark, no pun intended. But we do get EVPs from time to time, and sometimes they're really, really great ones. And the one that we got at the old Westminster Church was very clearly a female voice saying, I think they're looking for a ghost. And what was interesting about it was a female, and I know that I was the only female there, and she had a Scottish accent, which I couldn't even pretend to have. So it could not have been me. So when you watch the TV shows and you hear these EVPs that they catch, it's great and it's interesting, but you never know. Like, is there someone behind the scenes? Is that a producer that's recording it? You never know. But I was there. I know that it wasn't me. And that's always stuck with me. And I think that was one of the first investigations that I ever went on. We had another one where it was out in Hagerstown. It was an old factory, like a car factory that had been turned into apartments, and these people were just having experiences left and right, and they couldn't explain it, and they thought they were going crazy, a lot like you saw today. And we had a lot of things happen while we were there, which doesn't happen all the time. We had a couple of glasses knocked into the sink. We actually caught a shadow going across one of our cameras, which was really interesting. And one of the greatest pieces of evidence that we caught was a voice, again, in an accent, and I can't really recall what type of accent it was, but it was not an American accent, saying, I'll scare her if you want me to. Because we, from all the time, will say, come on, like, scare me, do something. Like, you know, kind of trying to push the envelope a little bit, see if you can get a reaction. And of course, we didn't hear that while we were there, but when we went back and reviewed the tape recorder, we heard this voice, and the client that lived there didn't really recognize the voice, so I can't say for any certainty that that entity was connected to them in any way. It could have been someone who died in that factory when it was a factory. It could have been someone who lived on that land before the factory was even there. I don't even know. But yeah, that was a good piece of evidence.
So we're almost out of time. So as we close this out, some closing thoughts from the three of you. And I'm one of the things that the people, when they argue about what is actually going on, as in this play or anywhere else, is some people who do the work that you all do will say that somebody is stuck in a place and has to get out. They're between places and need to go. You're positing in some ways, Gwen, that people are just there, or whatever it is just there. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. There's always this. I've heard both these things. What do those mean?
Well, stuck can be that you're going over something over and over again, but then I would conjecture there are a whole lot of us that are stuck here right now. You know, the idea is, you know, I think that the answers are in heaven and earth. I think that when you're ready and, you know, the spirit moves you, whether you're dead or alive, you'll move on. You know, we move on. And we've got, you know, the hope for eternity. I mean, the idea is this is forever, folks. You can build upon what you know and how you feel. And I'd like to leave you all with a thought also about, you know, with the music and the numbers that you see on license plates or on the, you know, you turn it to the clock and every day it's the same number. You just happen to see that same time on the, you know, the clocks in your house. What makes you do that? What makes you turn at that exact time? You know, it's not your brain. You know, it's your spirit saying, see, you do hear us. You do know we're here. So, you know, stuck, I don't believe in that. I don't believe in a God that would leave you stuck. I believe in a God that gives you the tools and is standing right behind you, just like Mom was when you were two and she was afraid you were going to fall, waiting there to pick you up. I just believe that very strongly. So when people talk about stuck, I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel about it.
So, and very quick, we'll go online here. And Hollis, just I'm curious where you wind up with all this in terms of what the literature is telling us and wrestling with us about.
Well, yeah, for me, the creator then is always the authorial creator, whether it's Shakespeare or Coward or Wordsworth or McKay or whomever. That's the creator. I mean, there may be other creators too, but those are the ones I'm concerned about. And when thinking about Blythe Spirit or Hamlet, the reason they're good works of literature is that they're irresolvable. It's irresolvable whether the two wives, the ghostly wives, are a matter of his guilt or his latent homosexuality or whatever it happens to be, or whether they're really there. Or in Hamlet, whether it's the ghost of his father that really returned, or whether Hamlet is like, oh my God, do I have to be king now? Or whatever it is, it doesn't matter that in that realm, those creators have created works that will live always because of their irresolvability.
Now it's your turn, Elise.
I think for me, and what Blythe Spirit kind of reminded me of is that I do this work because I'm very strongly connected to the past. I have a fascination with history and what has come before me, and I feel as if connecting with the paranormal, for lack of a better term, is my way of connecting my reality to past realities. And I've said this before earlier in our discussion, that just because we're not catching proof of what is happening doesn't mean that it's not there. And I think for even our characters in the play, just because we weren't seeing his two wives at the end doesn't mean they weren't there. And they were supposedly sent back to where they were supposed to be, but there was still a connection to him. There was still a connection to that space, and they were still able to manipulate it.
I thank Elise Caudill Corker, Dr. Gwen McGregor, Dr. Hollis Robbins for being here today, and thank Everyman Theater for the productions and letting us do this for every production and have these conversations. Thank you all so much for coming out as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear the show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.